हरिः ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे. Okay, so reading from Mahabharata, the Pandu cursed and blessed. After his attendants left, Pandu made his way into the forest with his wives. They walked steadily north for many days and finally arrived at Saptasrotra, the hundred-peaked mountain. There the king constructed a wooden hut and began to engage in severe penance. Many rishis, siddhas, and charanas lived in that region, and Pandu soon endeared himself to them by his qualities of humility, self-control, and devotion to his elders and to God. They would frequently visit his hut to converse with him. Right, so we see that his qualities, his piety was such that he could move in those areas of the Himalayas where all these great rishis and those who are on these higher platforms could live. Because there's areas that you can go into only if you have the qualification. Otherwise, you can't see them. You have to have a certain level of piety. Like we're staying on 1/9 of Bharadvarsha, right? So one part of it. Then you go up and you have the other varshas that are there, the Kimpurusha Varsha, Ilavrita Varsha, all these other places. So qualified persons like we see, like Pandu, Arjuna. And that they could go into these other regions. We read in the sixth canto about some of these other great kings and emperors, that they had the piety that they could go into these other areas. Otherwise, then you just see you go into the Himalayas, it's just snow. But they can go in and actually get beyond into these other realms and other regions and all that. You know, it's just like, let's say you have an ant walking around. It can't comprehend the whole layout on the table and, you know, what's going on in the dinner and all the family guests and, you know, what the occasion is. And all they can do is just, there's something in front of them here, and then they go to something, and if they keep walking, they can get around it here. They figure that out. But that's all that they know. So we're the same. Is that according to our piety, we know up to a certain level, and that's all. So the devotees, they can know then, you know, beyond whatever, all these different things. So these great personalities, they were able to deal on these platforms. With his mind fixed only on salvation, Pandu lived simply at Saptasrota. He ate only fruits and roots and drank clear water from mountain springs. His two wives accepted the same vows he had taken, and thus all three lived joyfully on the mountain like celestials descended from the higher regions. Right, so we can see from this is that he's fixed on the higher purposes of life, which is human life's meant for. So if you situate yourself like that, you will be satisfied. It's not that you won't be satisfied. The idea that I can satisfy myself by engaging the senses, collecting paraphernalia for engaging the senses, that no one's satisfied. Anybody who's working in that realm, they're not satisfied. So we see here is because he had a simple life, he had his strict vows, what he did, and the rest of the endeavor was towards self-realization, then he and his wives are satisfied, even though we see they have very minimal things. But they have very good association, they have good focus, they have the steadiness that's there, so they have satisfaction. Gradually over time, Pandu thought more about his situation. One day he spoke to the rishis, revealing his fears. O greatly learned ones, I have heard that a sonless man cannot attain heaven. By having sons, one pays his debt to the ancestors. If I die without issue, my forefathers will surely perish. As the Shraddha offerings will cease, I am thus filled with apprehension because I cannot beget children. So in the beginning, he's just worried about, you know, that curse is there and what happened and that, because the Kshatriyas would be very, very focused on something. And so then he goes in, he performs his austerities and that. But with time now, that starts to become a pleasant, you know, steady situation, so his mind can turn to wider things. And so now he's worried about the element that working within this field of karma, then he needs to have descendants who are going to perform the Shraddharats that will take care of the forefathers, like that. Devotees, then, they don't have to worry about these things because they're worshiping Krishna. He's the original forefather. And so by pleasing Krishna, then everybody else is taken care of. But here, because Pandu is the king, he's setting the example for all the personalities. So therefore, then, he performs these duties. But he does them to please Krishna. But he still performs so that those who are not necessarily so well situated in Krishna consciousness, at least they'll be situated in a pious position, which is useful for moving forward. It means it's an easier, means if you're pious, then you will listen to the sages, you'll accept Shastra, you'll accept duties and all these. So if you come across the pure devotees, then you could move forward. But if you don't accept the piety, then the things that are there are opposed to these things, like association devotees, chanting, worshiping the Lord, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. These are favorable. But if one is sinfully based in one's lifestyle, then one's not inclined towards any of these. So therefore, a pious person will be more inclined. That's why it's recommended. Though it won't produce bhakti, it's just a better environment in which it can come up. Right? So because of his curse, then he can't have children. So he's worried, then how will the dynasty go on? Pandu sighed in anxiety. He would often perform the Shraddha ceremony for the welfare of departed ancestors. The Vedas state that such food offerings made to the gods on their behalf ensure their continued happiness in heaven. The monarch was concerned. What would happen when he died? Who would continue the offerings to his forefathers and indeed to himself? He folded his palms in supplication. Great sages, see my afflicted state and mercy, and be merciful. I beg you to beget children in my wives, just as Vyas begot myself and my brothers. Right, so in the previous three ages, then this aspect of niyoga could be used. If somehow or another the husband can't beget children, and that due to whatever reason he either dies or some other aspect, then the brother of the husband could beget children on his wife. They're still his wives. The offspring are still his. The example is given that you have the field and you have seed. So now you want to plant something in the field, like I want to plant some corn in the field. I can say is that I planted the corn, it's my seed, so therefore what grows is mine, but it grows because of the field. So it's who owns the field, that's who it belongs to. So even if the brother begets children on the man's wife, the children will be the husband's because the field belongs to him. The wife is connected with him, therefore the field is him. It doesn't matter where the seed is, because seed can blow through in the sky. You know, there's so many ways it can get into the field. So that's the Vedic rule. It's who owns the field, that's there. Just like, let's say, not as wonderful a situation that you have, someone's married, and then somehow or another that's not working, and the woman marries someone else. And if she already has a child, now because she's connected with this new husband, because she's the field, that child is then connected to that person. It's not technically connected to the previous one. Though at the same time, as you do have the consideration that he's the father. So depending upon the arrangement, it's there. So it just depends. If the relationship's strong, then it's with this. If it's not, then he has the connection back. So the Vedas, they have their stand, but it's also, they have ways to deal with how it adjusts. So Vyasadeva then begat children on, what's his name? Yeah, Pandus and their father, Vichitravirya. But they're sons of Vichitravirya. So you see, they take on those qualities and everything and all that. Even though Vyasadeva is the father in the way he begets the children, but he's technically not the father. And so the same way is then he's saying, in the same method, then they would be here. Because you can say as no, but it's connected with here. But the point is the father's there. That's the family. You're born into that family, so you have the consciousness of that family. It doesn't matter where it came from outside. Does that make sense? It may have some flavor, but the point is in this case, then you're talking about Vyasadeva is a great sage, so you're talking about a higher consciousness. So then he's also approaching the great sages and saying the same thing. Smiling, one of the rishis replied, "By our ascetic powers, we have seen that you will undoubtedly have children like the gods themselves. Indeed, your progeny will fulfill the purpose of the celestials. All this we can clearly see. Therefore, you should certainly act in such a way as to somehow produce children. Consult first with your wives and then decide what should be done." Right? So now here is the point, is the sages can see these great sages like that they're moving with, can see past, present, and future. So they can see that the Pandavas are there and all these great things are done, you know, how they'll establish Dharma, the battle of Kurukshetra, how Duryodhana and all these impious kings will be destroyed. So they can see all that. So then they're saying, but at the same time this curse is there. Right, so the curse is there, but at the same time there's going to be children. So then they have to, the sage is saying, therefore consult with your wives and see what to do. Right, because they're not going to say we can tell by our mystic power that you have this thing and your wives have this, and then he's going to go, why didn't you tell me? Why do they know? Why don't you, you know? Because also when you're dealing with kshatriyas, you have to, that element of passion, you have to be very, very careful about that. So that's what he says, consult with your wives. Then if Kunti then says, I have this mantra, then it's a matter of that. Yeah? So Pandu reflected on the rishi's words. It seemed that the sages were amenable to his suggestion. He went to Kunti and spoke with her in private. "O lady of sweet smiles, I desire offspring, but due to my vicious behavior, I have lost my power of procreation. In such instances, the scriptures sanction that some other worthy man may beget children on my behalf. Please, therefore, accept another man and conceive a child for me." Pandu pointed out that even he and his brothers had been conceived in this way. Kunti should thus accept a qualified Brahman who is superior to him in order to have a child. Right? They're not going to accept someone inferior, but in this case, then someone superior. Or it can be also equal, because they were saying the brother. So technically, then the brother's there. In this case, then Vyasadeva was the brother, but at the same time as being a brother, but he was a Brahman. Like that, while the others were Kshatriyas. The noble Kunti did not like Pandu's suggestion. She looked down and spoke softly in reply. "O virtuous one, please do not request this of me. I am your lawful wife, ever devoted to you. I shall certainly not accept another's embrace, even in my imagination. O king, embrace me to beget offspring. I shall ascend to heaven with you. Who is superior to you?" Right, so the whole point is that if he wants offspring, then he can approach Kunti. From that, he may die, but then they'll both go to heaven. You know, like this. Kunti recited to her husband an ancient story she had heard. There was once a powerful king who had died without issue. His lamenting wife had embraced his dead body, and by the arrangement of the gods, she conceived children. Three qualified sons were bored of her union with her dead husband. Kunti asked Pandu to emulate that king. Right, so you're talking about people who have these great mystic powers and stuff like that. So there are some other details there. Pandu shook his head. "I do not possess such power. Our only recourse is the rishis. One of those great sages should conceive with you. I see no other way." The king assured her that no sin was attached to such an act. It was his responsibility, as he was commanding her as her husband, and she should not hesitate to comply with his request. Pandu tried in many ways to convince his wife. So he's quoting from Shastra, and that it's sanctioned in scripture. It's not, you would say, your best option like that. It's just an aspect that in case nothing else is working, then it's an option that's there. But it's not that, oh yes, this is just as good an option as anything else. So when he's saying that there's no sin because it's recommended by Shastra. There's no sin because he is the husband he's saying, but it's based on Shastra. It's not that anything the husband says, then there's no sin. It's that it has to be based on Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So therefore, if there is any problem, it will be his responsibility. So he's saying from both of these aspects, then it should be fine. At last, Kunti Singer's husband's determination said to him, "I shall tell you of a boon I received while in my maidenhood, which may yet prove to be our deliverance. When I was a girl in my father's house, he would engage me in serving guests," right? Because by taking care of the guests, then they accrue so much piety, right? Because taking care of guests, Atithi Seva, is of great piety, and especially in those days with the kings, you'd have all the great sages and other things coming like that. So specifically, she would take care of them. You know, the Kshatriyas, they have servants and all that, but the sages then. So then by her coming and, you know, taking, you know, doing menial service and all that, they get great piety. And by that piety, then it'll make their life go well, their family life go well and everything. One day, the powerful mystic Durvasa arrived. By my service and constant attention to all his needs, I greatly pleased that Rishi. As he was leaving, he called me aside and said, "Gentle maiden, I shall confer upon you a boon. Listen as I recite a mantra. This mantra uttered by you will summon any of the celestials you desire. Whether agreeable or not, they will be obliged to do your bidding." So even if they weren't interested, let's say they had a cricket match to go to or something like that, if she chants the mantra, they come, they have to attend. Like that. Kunti already had experience of the mantra's power. As soon as she had uttered it once and thought of Surya, that blazing deity had appeared before her. She had then conceived a son. Kunti therefore knew that she could summon other gods to produce further children. She had not wanted to reveal the secret, being reluctant to unite even with the gods in place of her own husband. Right? So the chastity, she's satisfied with her own husband, and so she's not interested in anyone else. And you see, because of that element of a relationship, because it's that aspect that's the important. It's not the quality of the ingredient that makes it better. It's the quality of relationship. We even see with I don't remember her name, but I think she was married to Chyavana Rishi. And Chyavana, yes, so then she was married to Chyavana Rishi, and then, yeah, so all these great person, or at the marriage ceremony or something, I can't remember exactly, I think it was Chyavana. So the girl is there, and all the demigods, because they know this, they all take on that form. Oh, I think, because she married him, and he wasn't very attractive. Because he was he was elderly. He was, you know, meditate under the water, so his skin's all wrinkly and all these kind of things. So he wasn't attractive at all. But he ended up marrying the girl. Then he had a relationship with the Ashwini Kumaras, you could say the doctors of the demigods, and that he had made an arrangement that they could get a share in the sacrifices. Otherwise, they were left out. Only the main demigods wouldn't get. So he arranged that they got. So then they came in like this, and so they took him and went into the water, you know, and she was there, went down in the water. When they come up, then they all, because they were very, very beautiful. So they all came up, then they all, you know, also the husband looked like one of the Ashwini Kumaras. So then, you know, then it was said, so now choose your husband, you know. And so she couldn't tell. So then she prayed to the Ashwini Kumaras that by their blessing she would get the intelligence to understand which one is her husband. So in other words, she was being offered, be married to one of the Ashwini Kumaras and be a, you know, and move to the heavenly planets and all that. She didn't want it. She just wanted her husband, right? Does that make sense? Same. And another thing, I think, was also with Nala. Nala and Damayanti. It's mentioned in another part. That at her Swayamvar, because that was a Swayamvar before she got married, then all the demigods knew she wanted to marry Nala. So when she came down for the Swayamvar to choose, every demigod that was, all the demigods came because she was so beautiful. So she, I think, had the benediction. She was the most beautiful female in the universe. Like that. Nala was the most beautiful person in the universe. So he was more beautiful than anyone, you know, except for the transcendental personages like Lakshmi Narayan. But of anybody else who was conditioned, he was the most beautiful. And she was the most beautiful female. So everybody, all the demigods came to marry her. And so then when she came with the garland and that, when she came and looked, everybody had taken the form of Nala. So you have there hundreds of Nullas, you know. And so with that in mind, you know, the idea is one of the demigods will get her as a wife. But she just went up to each one and watched and then moved on to the next and then went to the next and went like that until she'd gone through everyone till she found Nala. And then she put the garland. So the demigods were impressed. How did she know? That's because she said demigods don't blink. Humans blink. So she just waited long enough for how long it would be before you'd normally blink. Because Nala's not going to try to keep his eyes open. So she just went until the one who blinked, that was Nala. So the demigods were very pleased, you know, because of the chastity, the focus and everything, the intelligence, the determination. And she wasn't distracted. You know, she wasn't thinking, oh, I can marry a demigod. She was thinking, no, I've given my heart to Nala, and so I'm going to marry him. Like that. So that kind of aspect, that chastity, that commitment in relationship, that's very much appreciated. Because you see, Krishna is totally committed to the devotee, and the devotee is totally committed to him. So that's the basis of you know, how you say, personal relationships, personal interaction. So that's why it's a great thing. So then you see with the women, and then there's that aspect of the chastity. And so, because that creates the basis of all the interactions in the family and that. So therefore, she wasn't interested. Even though she could call demigods, she's married Pandu, she's satisfied. She's not interested, hey, I could, you know, hang out with some demigods. She wasn't interested. But this was an emergency. Okay, she had not wanted to reveal this secret, being reluctant to unite even with the demigods in place of her own husband. But this was an emergency. It seemed that the time to make good use of Durvasa's mantra had come. Pandu, who had known nothing about the boon, was overjoyed upon hearing Kunti's words, right? Because here it's gone through, he's presented it, she's not, they discuss it, he's trying to convince this and that, then she's seeing his determination, because she was thinking, okay, she'll say and they'll just leave it. But no, he's determined, so then she's, okay, I have this mantra. So it's not that the sages don't know this, but it should come. It's a thing between husband and wife. Otherwise, the sages say it, then it's just like a formality or something like that. He goes, oh, you have this mantra and that. So where's the interaction? Because the whole point of the husband and wife is their interaction. Pandu, who had not known anything about the boon, was overjoyed upon hearing Kunti's words. This was surely the Lord's arrangement, right? Because the Lord had arranged this before, because all these things are going to happen. And then it's an amazing thing, because the Pandavas, they're great devotees. They represent the demigods. Duryodhana, then he's got, you know, issues, and he represents the demons. And so then there's this whole, you know, great fight between the demigods and the demons, are good and evil and all these different things. So the Lord had all these arrangements. Sons from the gods would be far superior to any born of earthly men. Right, so then here, they'll be such special children. Kunti asked her husband which of the deities she should call. Pandu thought for some moments and then said to his wife, "Oh, beautiful lady, you should call the great, great Dharma, God of Justice. He will never pollute us with sin, and his son will undoubtedly be qualified in every way." Right, so he's a great devotee, one of the Mahajans. He is, you know, everything he does will be religious. It'll never be against, because that's what he does. He's the, you could say, the empowered incarnation of religiosity, to follow the rules, the judgment, to see that everyone is doing everything properly and to see. So for a king, he has to rule with that equal vision according to Shastra, judge everything properly and all that. They're constantly judging. So in that way, the king always represents Yamaraj. So he's saying, you know, we should call Yamaraj, because then you're going to have a righteous, you know, son. Kunti assented to Pandu's request. She sat in meditation and thought of Dharma, reciting the mantra Durvasa had given her. Within moments, the deity appeared, riding in a resplendent chariot, shining like the sun. He smiled and said to Kunti, "What should I do for you?" Awed by the god's splendor, Kunti replied in a trembling voice, "I desire a child by your illustrious self." Dharma at once united with her in a spiritual form and then disappeared. Kunti conceived and in due course gave birth. During the eighth month of the year, at noon on a full moon day, when the auspicious star Jyeshta was in the ascendant, she brought forth a lustrous son. As soon as he was born, a celestial voice was heard in the sky. "This son will be the best and most virtuous of men. He will be devoted to truth, highly powerful and famous throughout the three worlds. Known as Yudhishthira, this boy will rule the earth." So you can tell they're special children, because otherwise how often do you have when a child is born and a voice from the sky then proclaims all these kind of things, right? So you know that they're special. Pandu was overjoyed. The gods had not forsaken him after all. Here was a child worthy of his great dynasty. He no longer had to be anxious. Then he began to consider the situation. He saw that by Durvasa's boon, Kunti could obtain more powerful sons, born of the gods themselves, who would ensure the Kuru's welfare and become great leaders in the world. So he's thinking that you have the one son, okay, now his duty to the forefathers is taken care of and you have someone to rule. But at the same time, you have to maintain the whole kingdom, do so many other things. So more sons means they can take up more aspects of managing the kingdom. So then it'll be more strong, more powerful. Pandu approached Kunti again a year after Yudhishthira's birth and said, "The wise have declared that a ruler should possess strength as well as righteousness," right? Because the first one is righteousness. "Therefore, please invoke the wind god, Vayu, the strongest of the demigods. By him we shall get a son who will be the most powerful man on earth." Right? So, because the king represents all these different demigods, the main demigods. And so then by this, then he's thinking of all the qualities of the king. So then you see he's starting through this list of the eight demigods. Kunti folded her palms and bowed in assent. She again sat in meditation, this time calling for Vayu. In moments, the god appeared, riding a huge deer. In a voice that sounded like thunderclouds, the effulgent god said with a smile, "Oh, Kunti, what do you desire from me?" Right? So she's qualified as an individual. You know, her character, her qualities, her, you know, everything like that. That she could get Durvasa's blessing, that she could have the mantra, that she could use the mantra. Because it's not that just because you have the mantra, you have to have heard it from the proper source and you have to have that potency to be able to use it. So Kunti is able to use it. She has that power. So the qualities that are there, you know, are godly qualities. So when the demigods come, it's not like there's, you know, somebody there that doesn't have nice qualities. You know, so they're impressed with the qualities, they deal with her as a godly person. Kunti was bashful as she replied, "Oh, best of the celestials, please give me a son who will possess immense bodily strength and who will be capable of humbling the pride of all." Right? Because if you have that, you have a righteous, you know, the righteous king, you have one who can humble everyone else's pride, that they'll then follow the righteous king, because he being the younger brother, naturally, then Yudhishthira would be the king, and by him being there, then he can control all these others so that they will follow properly Yudhishthira. Then everything will go very nicely. The kingdom will be very righteous in that. The god agreed, and by his yogic power, he approached Kunti and conceived a child within her womb. When Vayu's child took birth, a voice was again heard in the sky saying, "This child will be the best of all those endowed with strength and power." Pandu and Kunti were even more joyful to see their second son, whom they named Bhima. Along with Madri and in the company of the Siddhas and Rishis, they lovingly raised their children in the remote and beautiful woodlands on the mountainside. Right, so they lived there in the forest, and they were there. That's their lifestyle. And then, you know, they have their children. They raised their children there in that environment with the great sages and that, and the great in this holy place. So you can see everything's very, very auspicious, very religious. Some months after Bhima's birth, Kunti was sitting near the edge of a mountain cliff, with Bhima asleep on her lap. Suddenly, a tiger roared nearby. She jumped up in fear, and the baby rolled from her lap over the cliff edge. Struck with horror, Pandu quickly descended the cliff. When he reached the bottom, he saw the child lying unharmed amid a pile of rocky fragments. The baby had landed upon a large rock and had smashed it to pieces. Right, so he was strong. Right? He falls off the cliff, lands on a big rock, smashes the rock to pieces, and then he's just sitting there peacefully. So the rock was a cushion for him. In amazement, Pandu gently lifted his child and took him back to Kunti. Even with two sons, Pandu continued to reflect on the future of his dynasty. He thought, success in this world depends upon exertion, but exertion is always subordinate to destiny. Yet even destiny is controlled by the will of the Supreme Lord. How then can I attain a son who will be the best of all those devoted to the Lord? Pandu thought of Indra, the king of the gods, right? So his whole point is that, okay, you're doing things religious, you make that endeavor, all that, but that depends on destiny, that's controlled by the Supreme Lord. So someone who's a devotee of the Lord, that's the best. Right? So now he has the religious son, he has the powerful son, now he's wanting that devotional son. No, they're all devotees, but of the Pandavas, Arjuna is the one that we always, when we think devotee, we think Arjuna. All the other, they're all great devotees, but he's the one that stands out. Just like they're all strong, but when you think of strength, it's Bhima. They're all religious, but then it's Yudhishthira. So, yeah. Pandu thought of Indra, the king of the gods, and a famous devotee of the Lord. Indra had formerly performed 1,000 sacrifices for Lord Vishnu's pleasure, and he possessed immeasurable might, prowess, and glory. From him would surely come a son who would be superior to all. And we see, when it came to the fighting and all these things, he was the best. Even though Bhima was the strongest, but prowess in battle, it was Arjuna. So, yeah. Pandu consulted with the rishis and was advised that he and Kunti should practice an ascetic vow for 1 year to please Indra. At the end of that period, Kunti could summon the demigod with her mantra. So in this case, because they wanted a great devotee and that, and they were approaching Indra in his devotional position, right? Because demigods are all 33 million, they all have to be devotees of Vishnu. But it's just that he being the king, there has to be that more aspect. But you see, sometimes he gets distracted, and so we know so many stories there. But as he's pointing out here, he does things to please Vishnu. So it's not that he's not a great devotee. So then by doing this austerity for a year, then they would have that piety, and they would have that, they would please him so he would come, and so that they would get a son. Otherwise, yes, maybe they'll get someone who's a nice, good manager and organizer and things like that, but they want someone who's a devotee. The monarch and his wife then accepted a vow of standing on one leg from sunrise till sunset, taking neither food nor water. They kept their minds absorbed in meditation and prayer for one complete year, with an aim to please Krishna. Yes, because in Dwapara Yuga, then you could live just off of air. In Satya Yuga, in doing meditation and austerities, as long as you keep the life airs moving within the bones, you would stay alive. Like we see Hiranyakashipu, he was doing his austerities and the white ants came and ate his body. So all that's left is the bones. But he is, through his meditation, the life airs are moving within the bones. And so then Brahma comes and then sprinkles water and then, he gets his body back. But he's still alive there. In the Treta Yuga, when you do austerities like that, you have to keep the skin on the bones. Like that. So you have to be careful that you don't get eaten by ants or something. In the Dwapara, but in both of these you don't have to breathe, right? But in Dwapara Yuga, then you do the austerity, so you have to keep the life air in the bones, which you're doing anyway. You have to keep the skin on the body, but you have to have some breath. So you just need some air, now and again. Okay, and in Kali Yuga, you need a handful of rice. At the end of the year, Indra spoke to Pandu in his meditation. I have become pleased with you, O king. I shall give you a son who will protect religion and chastise the wicked. He will delight his friends and relatives and slay his foes. Indeed, this boy will be the best of men. Right? So you see is that it's working out the way they wanted. So it's that's why you see is on top of it, these personalities, all great devotees. But because of the presentation in Mahabharata, it's emphasizing more on religion than on that God consciousness. That the God consciousness and underlying, so sometimes you don't see it, but they're all these personalities here, all the Pandavas, they're all great devotees. Though in the story, sometimes you may remember that or not. But the point is, underlying, they're all great devotees. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki Jai.